ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In a moment, beloved listeners, we'll hear from the editors of an extraordinary new book of letters, penned by, two of Australia's literary greats. The correspondence begins thus. Dear Elizabeth, if I may call you that, my mother has let me read your so nice letter with its lovely and generous words about me. The recipient of the letter was one Elizabeth Harrowin and the writer Shirley Hazard. And so began a complex friendship that spanned 40 years and half the globe, and it was at times joyful, erudite and difficult. Susan Windham is sitting opposite me in our little monk cell at the ABC. Susan is a writer, journalist and former literary editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. And Brigitta Olibas is Professor of English at the University of New South Wales and the author of a 2022 Hazard biography. And their book is Hazard and Harrower, The Letters, and I welcome you both. Brigitta, how did they meet? Now, I want to set this up a bit. I've spent much of the last 30 years living in Potts Point in Macleay Street, and I used to like going to the Macleay bookshop, which was absolutely overflowing with books in disordered random on horizontal on the shelves, as I recall. It plays a part.
Yes, it does. So Shirley Hazard's mother lived in Sydney, in Potts Point, and in the late 1960s, while Shirley was living happily in New York, happily far from her mother and far from the rest of her family, Shirley's mother was unwell, suffered from mental illness, and this was a bad period in her life. And Elizabeth Harrower later told the story that Kit Hazard was often seen wandering a little déshabillé up and down the streets. And
what was her problem? Was it bipolar?
She was apparently later diagnosed with bipolar, okay, which was, you know, clearly not as well understood at the time. And Norma Chapman, the proprietor of the Clay Bookshop, saw her and contacted Elizabeth Harrower because she felt there would be some kind of literary connection between Shirley Hazard's
mother. What an astute,
absolutely
bit of
astute,
marriage
bookish
making,
people,
isn't it?
Right? Yeah. Bookish people, knowing their, you know, their like-minded people.
And so they began corresponding fairly regularly from 1971.
Yes, the first letters are from the late 1960s. I think 67, but 66. Thank you, Susan. This is why it's so good to have a team of editors. And they were writing right up until Shirley became incapacitated with dementia, and then the letters peter out.
Now, Susan, both women were very prolific letter writers, spending so many hours writing lengthy missives to one another, one wonders how they find time to write anything else.
That's exactly right. Not to mention the friendships in person with many people. But, yeah, of course, people did write letters in those days, but Shirley and Elizabeth put a lot of creative energy into their correspondence with many other people. This collection of letters over 40 years is one of the largest for both of them, and really covers everything from their own lives and writing to literature and politics and world events. And you do wonder, and the letters go back and forth almost every week for many, many years.
How many pages in a typical envelope?
They varied from a one blue aerogram up to, what, five, six, eight letters.
Wow.
And often it was filled with details of Kit Hazard, the mother, and her latest ventures and mishaps.
Are we talking of a quill dipped in ink or a
beautifully
typewritten,
typed on their
usually
little
typed.
You know, well, they had different typewriters at different times, but very cleanly typed, punctuated, every sentence a beautiful piece of writing.
Brigitta, we're talking of a different time, aren't we?
Absolutely.
I mean, these days, I get so few letters. I used to get them by the truckload. They've evaporated.
Yes. I mean, I feel email does replace a little bit some of what letters used to do. Of course, email is a legacy kind of medium now. I think it's something only older people write, just like it was only older people really who wrote letters then.
Are you serious? Are you telling me that emails are on their way out? Like me?
Perhaps. Look, perhaps. But there was obviously great pleasure that the two of them took in recording their lives and thoughts and days in this way. They also spoke by phone. They would ring each other up, obviously at considerable expense, and they would often refer to those phone conversations and follow up with a couple of additional points in the letters.
Brigitte, if it's possible to generalise about the tone of the letters, because, well, they so vary, but one would say that there's something quite sensual about the world they evoke.
Both these writers are wonderful writers of place. They are extraordinary observers of the world around them, and both of them take this great pleasure in remarking upon it. In fact, William Sean, the editor of The New Yorker, used to say that one of his greatest pleasures in life was to ring Shirley up when she was living in Naples or Capri, one of her frequent stays there, and ask her to describe the scene from her balcony. Mm-hmm. He said it was like one of your favourite novels that you kept going back to. So she writes these very, as you say, sensual, very evocative, very poetic accounts of the very beautiful world that she's living in, or indeed the energy of New York, where she's living the rest of the time.
And Elizabeth would write about Mossman, the Blue Mountains, and travels through rural New South
and
Wales.
Her observations are a little quirkier. They're often about a family of birds or her gardener, and there's this more humorous, less kind of precious and serious take on the world around her. Both wonderful to read.
Now, Susan, they both read so much, didn't they?
They did. An extraordinary amount. And as you say, how did they write anything themselves, which becomes an issue for Elizabeth in particular, who did stop writing. But yes, they not only were very familiar with all the classics, but they were keeping up with the latest books, whether it was by Saul Bellow and Nadine Gordimer or Patrick White and Christina Stead. And they always...
And the movies too.
And the movies. Elizabeth loved movies. She was quite an avant-garde fan of cinema. She was very liberal-minded and excited by it.
What I find intriguing is that Shirley's letters show signs of being rewritten, fine-tuned, edited.
Yes.
She didn't just send off the first draft.
Well, apparently she did write drafts of her letters and kept some of them, so Brigitte had proof of that when she was reading through them. And, you know, to craft a letter so carefully, they must have known they were going to be kept, surely.
Is letter writing a pastime for either of you?
I would have to say no for me. When I lived in New York for many years and also a year in London earlier in my life, I wrote a lot to my back home to my parents in Sydney, and I'm so glad to have those letters. They both kept them for me, and I spent a lot of time writing letters and to friends as well. And it was just part of life then. But I think when you're at home, and in our modern age, it's just not necessary. I write the odd one, usually a thank you letter.
I also wrote letters when I left Tasmania, when I moved away. I don't think any of those have been kept. I think all that records
Now the
too,
word so. Kept comes.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've got to focus on that. I'm a hoarder. The National Library has 600 boxes of my correspondence, which stopped, you know, 10 or 15 years ago with the arrival of social media. But writing letters is one thing. Keeping letters is another.
Well, you know, Shirley Hazzard was a hoarder too, and there weren't, you know, 600 boxes, but there were some big trunks, and there were just piles and piles of letters, fan letters.
And Elizabeth tossed things out. She was a tosser.
Well, she did toss some letters out. She did burn at apparently at Shirley's mother's request when Shirley's mother was dying. She burnt Shirley's letters to Kit, which I feel very keenly because I feel there would have been writing about writing there that would have been really interesting and really valuable. But as an example of one of the great finds amongst the chaos of the trunks of letters and newspaper clippings and so on in Shirley's apartment, I found a blue aerogram from a C. Blake of Hurstville, and I opened it up wondering what Mrs. Blake of Hurstville was sending Shirley Hazzard, and it was a letter from Christina Stead, the other great Australian novelist of the period, whom Elizabeth Harrow had introduced Hazzard to. So hoarding definitely has its, you know, its upside.
Elizabeth, to my chagrin, has told me that she had thrown out all the letters she wrote to her mother and received from her mother when she was living in London in the 1950s and writing most of her novels.
Why?
Because it contained very private material, the sort of thing that a biographer would like to know. And she kept diaries but didn't, she wrote diaries but didn't keep them either. So it's very frustrating because they would have been a hoard of great material. But she curated her papers very carefully before giving them to the National Library. And there's a lot of correspondence there with interesting people, but not the things she didn't want us to know.
I knew Shirley a little and remember vividly she had a passionate interest in current affairs.
Yes. And you had that marvellous conversation with her in 2005 on your little radio show, little wireless show, I'm sorry, I'm being terribly modern.
Please, please.
And, yes, I mean, you ranged over such extraordinary subjects from the United Nations to Australia in the years of Whitlam and post-Whitlam.
Forgive what sounds like a vulgarity, but I feel a grab coming on. Let's have a quick listen to a bit of my interview with, yes, Shirley Hazzard.
In 84, in the Boyer Lectures, you spoke of coming of age in Australia. Do you think we have come of age now?
In Australia?
Hmm.
I was thinking of Australia growing up because it has had a very rough founding, the Australia we know, and that lasted, the scars of so much endurance and so much suffering lasted well into my lifetime. And I think it's not that those things ever quite go away, but I think the change in population, the change in generations has made a tremendous difference in Australia. And Sydney is a huge city, of course, and very beautiful to come to. This glorious light, which is the light of the early winter, after all, is beautiful. All these things are things that, in some cases, like the light, it's very reminiscent to me, but it's not something we commented much on. There was a great deal of pride in the harbour, as if we, instead of God, had created it.
Good heavens, that was from a chat I had with Shirley Hazzard back in 2005. Wow. Elizabeth was interested in Gough, wasn't she?
Elizabeth was a huge fan of Gough Whitlam. She was always a Labour voter. She came from a working class family in Newcastle who'd been very involved in industry up there, and I think she had a great sense of social justice and rich and poor inequality, and it just led her naturally to support Whitlam, and she was so thrilled. And she happened to be in Canberra visiting Christina Stead, and she writes this to Shirley on the day of the dismissal.
Oh, my heavens.
So we get this terrific eyewitness report in her letters. And she rushed to Parliament House and stood there raging with the other protesters, and just she was actually in despair at the way Whitlam was treated.
I think quite a few of us are still in despair some considerable time later.
Yeah.
Now, Brigitte, they shared something else apart from their fascination with literature and writing and politics, and that were unhappy childhoods.
Yes. Yes, both of them very dark childhoods. Both of them let us know that, but only obliquely. Shirley often said that the great comic character Dora from The Transit of Venus was a very mild version of my mother, was how she put it. And she did speak to other people of really terrible stories from her childhood. And I feel very much, from having read all her diaries and all her letters and all her novels, that there is this encrypted loss, this sense of great pain and grief at the heart of all her writing, that a lot of its force and strength comes from. The fact that she won't, she can't let go of that deep unhappiness, which is somehow bound up for her with Australia and very much embodied with her mother. And she keeps trying to... She keeps believing that her mother will get better.
That's so poignant, isn't
Absolutely
it?
Absolutely poignant. And Elizabeth too, there's, again, the defences that the two of them put up to shield themselves from this sense of not being loved.
So Elizabeth is born into a working-class family. Parents separated when she was young, and all sorts of unpleasantness follows.
Absolutely. Shirley's born into a much wealthier family, but she pretended that it was a lot more proper than it was. Both her parents were illegitimate and came from very, very benighted backgrounds. Whereas Elizabeth, there's a continuity, I suppose, across her life. She lived in circumstances of you know, that were materially a lot more comfortable. But
she described herself, Elizabeth, as being a divorced child, which I think was the source of all her fiction later, the broken marriages, the unhappy couples, and her own mixed experience with men, apparently.
Now, Brigitte, how did Elizabeth become so responsible for Kit?
This is one of the great mysteries. We know from the research Susan's done that Elizabeth took responsibility for a lot of unfortunate people, a lot of people who were difficult and very
time
consuming.
She never had children of her own.
She did not.
Had a mothering instinct for others.
Oh, maybe not. I'm not sure I'd make that connection. But she was interested in Kit. She found Kit was smart and complex and funny, and Elizabeth enjoyed all of that. Elizabeth liked complex and interesting people, and she seemed to take with it that the fact that they were going to be difficult. She later told the story that Shirley kind of let her take it all over, but there's a lot of evidence in the letters that Elizabeth was really up for it. She did mention that her own mother had just died, and she felt, it seems, that was one of the reasons for being interested in Kit. But I think she chose to do it and went on choosing to do it.
So Kit, the mother, does she have other children?
There's Shirley's older sister, Valerie. Shirley and Valerie loathed each other from childhood. There are no records of anything pleasant being exchanged between the sisters. This was another reason for Shirley's profound unhappiness. It wasn't just the horror of her mother, the neglect of her father, the brutal neglect of her father, but she and her sister were completely antipathetic and remained so. And when Valerie's oldest son moved back to the US, the children had been born there, he moved back, and he wrote to Shirley and said, "I would love to come and meet my famous aunt." And she was very quite dismissive and didn't want to know him. And speaking to him decades later about this, I could hear the hurt in his voice.
Really?
At that rejection.
Yeah.
The coldness that she would not be reconnected with her family, whereas she was a very generous, aunt figure to the children of friends and grandchildren of friends.
Susan, that old curmudgeon Patrick White had a few unkind words of warning for Elizabeth on the question of Kit.
Yes. After she'd met Shirley and her husband Francis in London, and I think Kit was travelling the world at the same time, he said, "If Kit is headed back to Sydney, whatever you do, don't get involved, because you'll never get rid of her," basically. And he was very right. He was always trying to urge Elizabeth to write more. They were close friends. very warm, close friends who would talk to each other on Sunday mornings on the phone, often went to each other's place for dinners and lunches. And he really admired her writing and was always saying to Elizabeth, why aren't you writing? Why are you letting other people soak up so much of your time? He described them as vampires, basically. And
well, he was doing the right thing, in
he
effect.
Was. He was,
because Elizabeth's writing
it.
Does start to dry up, does it not?
Absolutely. An interesting sideline to that, because the last novel she wrote was in 1971, so that's the beginning of this friendship, and she withdrew it from publication. It was only published much later. And one of the things she used to say was that, or one of the things she said to me was that, Frances only once said to her that you should be writing instead of looking after Shirley's mother, and then she said to me, and Shirley never said it. And yet, letter after letter after letter, Shirley Hazard is writing to Elizabeth Harrower, I hope you are writing, can we look forward to another story,
yep.
You know, apologising for the time that Kit is taking. Yeah. Because
and
it
then
is
saying, could you do this for Kit, and could you...
Yes.
Could you apply for a pension, and could you buy her some clothes?
Exactly, yeah.
Now, Susan, letter writing clearly allowed the friendship to blossom, but one also wonders if it would have survived had it been conducted in person.
Mm. It's a very good question. They only met, I think it was 6 times.
You're kidding.
Yes, because Elizabeth developed a great aversion to travel. She hated going on ships. She'd had a terrible storm on a ship once when she was travelling up the coast of Africa, and she really just withdrew from travel altogether. So she and Shirley met for the first time in London in 1972, and then they met several times in Sydney when Shirley came out here to give the Boyer lectures or to promote a book or to receive her Miles Franklin Award. So they met out here when Shirley came on 3 or 4 occasions, and they got on very well. They had lovely times. Elizabeth held parties and dinners for her, introduced her to Patrick White and Gough Whitlam, in fact. And then there was one disastrous trip that ended it, when Shirley and Frances were always saying to Elizabeth, you must come to Italy, you must come to New York. They wanted to thank her for her care for Kit, but they also thought she'd enjoy travelling and seeing all the things that they loved. And Elizabeth went to Italy in 1984 after putting it off and putting it off for various reasons. And I think she enjoyed Italy, but she felt oppressed by Shirley's sort of domineering personality and endless chat and being in someone else's life and routine, and she ran away.
But before that, she behaved very badly herself.
She also behaved badly.
Shirley's account of the visit was she put Elizabeth up at the Hassler Hotel in Rome, and apparently Elizabeth, the only thing she mentioned was that her room did not have a view. Which sounds a little churlish to me, and was in a bad
also
temper.
Also sounds like a good book title.
Room Without a View.
Room Without a View, absolutely. And then at lunch on Capri one day said, she raised a toast and to Frances, the kindest person at the table. There was a very, very prickly exchange, and it's hardly surprising she ran away.
I've lost the plot somewhere, but you tell a story, one of you tells a story about a request for an interview with Shirley on matters of feminism.
Oh, that's me.
Right.
Yes, that was a letter that of my own that I found amongst her papers.
Oh, really?
Yes, somewhat embarrassingly. And sadly, I didn't keep her reply, which is the truly wonderful part of the story. So I wrote my first graduate thesis on Shirley Hazard back in the 1980s, and my supervisor, one Dame Leonie, Professor Dame Leonie Kramer, for my sins.
Really?
Was, yeah.
Small
yeah.
world department.
Yeah, quite. And Leonie Kramer, of course, makes an appearance in the correspondence.
I should tell the listener, who may not know why this is an amusing development, that she would go on to become the chair of the ABC.
Chairman, she insisted.
Did she?
Yeah, she wasn't going to have any gender-neutral terminology referring to her. So I wrote to Shirley Hazard because she was coming out to Australia, And I said, I'm writing my master's thesis on your work and I'm really interested in Australian writing and in feminism and women's writing. And it was this exactly the kind of earnest, enthusiastic, you know, gormless letter that you can imagine a young postgrad writing. And I got an aerogram back, you know, saying, you know, thank you for your letter and, you know, you're interested in my work, but polite things. And then, you know, I'm really not interested in being seen as an Australian writer. I'm not interested in being seen as a woman writer or a woman anything. I abhor feminism. I abhor nationalism. And, you know, on and on in that vein. And so you see, my dear Miss Olibus.
So she could be a curmudgeon too.
Quite. And so you see, my dear Miss Olibus, there is no point in us meeting, which would have been a fantastic letter to have kept.
Yes.
And foolishly I tossed it out in embarrassment.
Now, your understanding of the friendship between these two women evolved after Kit's death.
Yes. There's a real shift in the tone of the letters after the death of Kit. And after that visit, that fated visit to Italy, which was so unhappy. And it was as if something had shifted, something had broken. So in simple terms, Shirley wasn't writing to say, could you pick up go with Kit to pick up a hearing aid? Could you put in the pension application or whatever? There were no more demands or requests from Shirley. Instead, they were free just to exchange their fascinating thoughts and ideas on what they were reading, what they were watching. And there's a warmth and a calm in those later letters. And then, of course, towards the end, as we see Shirley sort of slip away, there's great poignancy in Elizabeth's wish to stay in touch with Shirley. She's watching. Shirley comes right back into the limelight again with The Great Fire, which won the National Book Award, and the Miles Franklin, extraordinarily, the two great national awards for that last novel. And it was a big bestseller. She was off around the world. And her letters to Elizabeth really decline at that point because she's just really busy doing things. But Elizabeth is there stalwartly still, you know, I do hope to hear from you again, which is at odds with her own representation of that friendship through that time and later. And I find that really fascinating that there's this disingenuity about it.
Do you hear that sort of distant rustling of paper? It's all the listeners rushing off to write letters.
Oh, I hope so.
And they're going to keep them and the replies, and we can meet and discuss the consequences of your collaboration in a few years' time. But thank you both for coming in, Brigitte Olibus and Susan Windham, co-editors of Hazard and Harrower. The letters, published by New South Books. And you can see this double act at the Sydney Writers Festival later this month. It'll be something to write home about. Thanks for coming in.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.